30 years ago, in a remote part of Ethiopia, paleoanthropologist Donald Johanson discovered what was then the oldest skeleton of an upright walking human ancestor, the famous Lucy skeleton. Well, a lot has happened in the last 10 years. One thing, Lucy has a family. The newest member is the recently discovered Dikika baby, a 3-year-old skeleton of the same species. And now our family tree appears to go back more than 6 million years as new fossil finds continue to fill in some of the gaps on that tree, answering some questions and raising others. We spoke with Don Johanson and science writer Blake Edgar nearly 10 years ago when their book From Lucy to Language was first published. And the revised edition of the book is just out, updating with the last decade's worth of findings. And they're here with us today to bring us up to date on the ever-changing field of human origins. And if you'd like to get in on the discussion, give us a call. Our number 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And as we did 10 years ago, actually, it was pioneering work on Science Friday. We actually put photographs on a website. Sounds strange that you had a photograph on a website, but in those days there weren't any. We put photographs on the website of fossil photos, and today we've got them up again. If you go to sciencefriday.com, there are fossil photos of the newest findings on sciencefriday.com that you can watch along with us as we talk about them. Let me introduce my guest. Donald Johanson is a co-author of From Lucy to Language. It's out again, reissued by Simon & Schuster. He's founder and director of the Institute of Human Origins and the Virginia M. Ullman Chair in Human Origins at Arizona State University in Tempe. And he joins us today from KJZZ in Tempe. Welcome back to the program.
Well, thanks, Ira. It's a pleasure to be back. You shouldn't have waited 10 years. So much has happened. I don't know how we're going to cover everything.
We got a while. Blake Edgar is a co-author with Dr. Johanson of From Lucy to Language, and he is an acquisitions editor in the Science Publishing Group at the University of California Press at Berkeley, and he joins us from the UC Berkeley campus. Welcome back to the program, Blake.
Thank you, Ira. It's great to be back with you and Don, and from my alma mater, no less.
Don, I understand you're just back in the country this week. You were working on something good, I'm sure.
Well, I am just back. I spent 2 weeks in South Africa. Most of it, fortunately, was a little vacation, long overdue. But, of course, I was close to all those wonderful Australopithecus sites and had an opportunity to visit with my friend Ron Clark, who has made a miraculous discovery. It's been known for quite some time. It's highlighted in our revised edition now. It's probably the most complete, and we hear this a lot, but one of the most complete skeletons of Australopithecus ever found. It's buried deep within one of the caves known as Sterkfontein. And in 1994, Ron found a little ankle bone in a box of antelope bones. And he said, boy, this doesn't look like an antelope. This has got to be a human ancestor. And he sent his collectors down into this huge cavern and found the exact spot on the wall where the bone had been broken decades ago. And during excavation now, he has a complete skull, parts of the backbone, both of the legs, parts of the arms, and a hand, which is curled almost as if it's in the death position. And I had a close-up look at this. It's an astonishing find, and it's probably going to turn out to be the oldest, most complete adult Australopithecus.
And where would we place this in relationship to Lucy? Living at the same time?
Well, pardon the pun. It's a bone of contention right now. I kind of think that it has affinities to Lucy's species, Australopithecus afarensis. It's been tentatively dated as well over 3 million years, and it may turn out that Lucy's species actually had migrated as far as southern Africa at that time. Final diagnosis, I think, has to await full excavation of the specimen.
There's one other really recent finding that was too new to have made it into your book, and that is the Dikika baby. Tell us about her.
Oh, the Dikika baby is just who could have a better-looking baby than this? This is a 3.3 million-year-old, virtually complete child skeleton. And what I mean by that, it was 3 years old when it died, 3.3 million years ago. It has got the entire skull, meaning the brain case, the lower jaw is still attached to the skull. It's got most of the backbone, both shoulder blades, tiny little, almost pea-sized kneecaps. It's got parts of arms and legs, and it is going to allow us for the very first time, I think, to really examine in great detail how a baby Lucy grew up to be an adult Lucy. It is a female. It's often referred to as Lucy's baby. It's about 100,000 years older, so it obviously couldn't be her baby, but it's the kind of baby that Lucy would have had. So it expands our understanding of Lucy species, and there's no doubt that this belongs to Afarensis, because in 1975, we did find the first baby skull not far from where Lucy was found, and it looks identical to this specimen.
Mm-hmm. And according to what I've seen and read about it, it has the hips and legs of a creature that would walk upright, but the climbing ability of its ancestors. Well,
that's right. We don't have there's no pelvis preserved like there is in Lucy, but there mm-hmm. is there are two knee joints, and by looking at the details of how those bones articulate, our shin bone and our thigh bone, it's beyond question that this creature, when on the ground, was capable of upright walking just as we are. But there are hints, very interesting aspects, of particularly the shoulder blade, something that is almost unknown because it's really paper thin. But the aspects of that are very, very similar to a gorilla. And it suggests from the orientation of where our upper arm bone actually inserts into the shoulder that perhaps it could have really helped them climbing in the trees. I think they were primarily bipeds on the ground. But why not climb in the trees at night for safety? Why not climb in the trees for fruit, the sort of food that their ancestors were eating? I think we're looking at a species in transition. We're looking at a mosaic set of anatomy, very advanced towards us in being bipedal in the knee and hip, but still retaining ancient ancestral characters mm-hmm. in the upper part of the body.
Blake?
I can remember being here in Berkeley in 1983 at a symposium that Don's Institute hosted about the question of how terrestrial or arboreal Afarensis is or was. And it's just interesting to have this specimen now reopen that debate. And we've already seen varying opinions as to whether it's going to close the debate or just provide a new angle on it. But it's a fascinating specimen. It also reminds me the face and skull and the fact that you have an endocast, a cast of the brain from sandstone, reminds me of the Tong child that Raymond Dart found in the 1920s, which got a very different and much more negative reception, but was really the first fossil to point us all toward Africa as the place to look mm-hmm. for human ancestors.
Mm-hmm. On our website, we have a photo from the book, From Lucy to Language, this revised edition by Donald Johanson and Blake Edgar. If you go to sciencefriday.com and you look at that first picture in the top left, we have the honor of showing a 7-million-year-old Toumai man. Lucy is no longer the first family.
Well, no, Lucy is certainly not the oldest, but the Toumai specimen, as it's sometimes called, was found in Chad in north central Africa in 2001. It's a very crushed and distorted skull. It's been estimated to be between 6 and 7 million years. And opinion is very divided on this. There are some people who think it was an ancestor to a gorilla. There are others who think it might have been an ancestor to the later apes. And the discoverer, Michel Brunet, and his team in Poitiers, France, think that it was an ancestor to later hominids. So it's one of those provocative specimens, I think, about which we really need to know a lot more, meaning we need to find some more specimens of that age before we can ascertain whether it is a genuine hominid or an ancestor to later hominids. Because the biomolecular work is suggesting the split between the African apes, chimps and gorillas, and ourselves, humans, was something around 5 to 7 million years ago. So this specimen may be, in fact, too old for the common ancestor or even an ancestor to hominids.
Mm-hmm. And then we have moving closer to us, Blake, we have a bit younger than the Toumai man is the Millennium ancestor. Why was that such an important find?
Well, it's a very controversial find, and it was important because, there are several finds now competing for earliest hominid, and it's mm-hmm. one of them. You do have, it's mostly postcrania, although you have some dental fossils, but the most important ones are the two thigh bones, the femurs, and they indicate that it was likely bipedal, but again, this is a controversial point, and there's been a lot of fractious discussion among and debate among the people involved. Brunet find with Tumai, and in this case with the Millennium ancestor Aurorian, Brigitte Sanu and Martin Pickford. But it's interesting that as you get closer to this time period, this node when the human lineage and the chimp lineage come together, as Don was just describing, there seems to be a tendency to come up with not just new species but new genera of these ancestors. So there are lots of new names that we have to wrestle with and figure out how distinctive they really are. And it's going to be challenging to really tease out what were the real features of the earliest hominids other than bipedality, I think. And it, to me, it points to the fact that we need more ancient chimpanzee fossils as well. The ape fossil record is really still a black hole. The issue of Nature that described the chimpanzee genome a couple of years ago also had a short paper about the first bona fide chimpanzee fossils from Kenya. And we need more finds like that.
Donald, I got about a minute until the break, but are we beginning to fill in this last 10 years a good picture of a straight lineage?
Well, I think what we're beginning to fill in the time period between, say, 3 and 4 million years. The work we've continued to do at the site where Lucy was found at Hadar, the work that Meve Leakey's been doing in northern Kenya, is suggesting that there is a single lineage over at least 1 million years documented by these extraordinary fossils. The site of Hadar, we have close to 400 specimens of Lucy's species. And this is the most densely populated fossil species we know of. So it's beginning to reveal something about the tempo and the mode of human evolution.
Talking with Donald Johansson and Blake Edgar, co-authors of the new revised, updated, and expanded From Lucy to Language. This terrific book. If you're looking for a gift for the holidays this season, this is just a terrific coffee table book. And I'll tell you, it's a gorgeous book and a joy to read. And it's really, and it's educational, believe it or not. Stay with us. We have to take a short break. We'll be right back to talk more about From Lucy to Language. And take your phone calls. Don't go away. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about filling in the gaps in our human evolutionary tree with Don Johansson, co-author of The Revised From Lucy to Language, also co-author of Blake Edgar, our number 1-800-989-8255. How did you get such stunning photographs? I mean, taking these pictures was just terrific. I mean,
well,
the lighting, the whatever, you know?
That's right. I mean, I'm so envious of the photographer. I wish I had the ability to do this.
David Brill.
David Brill is a photographer based in Atlanta who I met way back in 1975. I'll never forget. I was in my camp, and a light, low-flying aircraft came over my site in the middle of Ethiopia, and I knew it was a National Geographic photographer arriving, and I was late to pick him up, and I arrived, and he was sitting under an acacia bush with all of his equipment waiting for me, and he really caught the bug. He really got terribly interested in the subject and began to look at the kinds of photographs that were available and realized that there was really nothing out there. And David has dedicated his life to working on a method that would bring these fossils literally to life. They're almost three-dimensional.
Yeah, they're just amazing photos.
I was just going to say, I watched him work in Nairobi 20 years ago, setting up the photograph that appeared on the front cover of the first edition of the book of the Nari Academy Boy. And it just takes hours for him to get one image, as he's so meticulous in the use of mirrors to capture and highlight aspects of the anatomy.
We don't do them justice. We have some on our website at sciencefriday.com. You can see some of the photos, but you have to really look at the book From Lucy to Language. Let's go to the phones, 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Robin in Boston. Hi, Robin.
Hi, how are you?
How are you?
Good. Hi, Don.
Hi, Robin. How are you?
I'm good. I just want to say I'm a very big fan of you and Lucy and your books. And Ira's right about From Lucy to Language. The pictures are just crazy good.
Thank you.
I have a question about the Nikika skeleton. You know, she's so gorgeous and she's so complete, but it's too bad we don't have those pelvic bones. How certain can you be that everything was excavated?
Did you leave anything there?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because that's something that always haunts us, whether we've missed something or in the field. I had the great opportunity to be invited by Dr. Zaresanai Alamseged. We call him Zarai. He was a postdoc, in fact, with me here in Tempe, Arizona, at the Institute and made the discovery when he was a postdoc at the Institute of Human Origins. And he invited me to come out to see the site, the Dakika site, which is just across the river from where Lucy was found. And I spent a month with him in the field excavating at the baby site. And I can say that this was one of the most thorough and complete recovery operations I've ever seen. He's been working at that site almost yearly for several years, extensively collecting all of the loose soil, meticulously screening it through several different size mesh screens, and I'm pretty darn sure that he has picked up every darn fragment of that skeleton that's out there. Maybe the pelvis is still buried inside the sandstone block that he's working on, but I can certainly attest that this was an extraordinary operation by really the first Ethiopian scientist to organize, lead, and make a major discovery on such an expedition in Ethiopia. He's extraordinarily... What's that?
I can quit worrying about it then.
Yeah, I wouldn't worry about it. I think that Zarai has done a splendid job and has collected everything that was on the surface.
Thank you.
Good luck. Have a happy holiday season to you.
Thank you, too.
1-800-989-8255. There was a lot of interesting speculation recently, a controversial find about the Flores man. There was a disagreement over whether this is a new species or just a small Homo sapiens. People called it the Hobbit. Where do we stand on that, Blake? What's happening with that?
Well, talk about a contentious find. It's really interesting. I think the jury's still out as to whether it's a pathological specimen. Robert Martin, who's an expert on the primate brain evolution, has argued this case that perhaps it the specimen that we have in the book suffered from mm-hmm. microcephaly. And, as we note in the book, it's a case where the facts are stranger than fiction. Really unusual to have something so small, so recent in time. Not unusual to have a dwarf on an island. We know that from pygmy mammoths on the Channel Islands off the California coast, for example, or the opposite, having Komodo dragons, the largest lizards in Indonesia. But the brain of this one is so small, it's really not significantly larger than the Dakika baby that we were describing earlier, but in an adult and in something that overlapped with modern humans. So I think more work needs to be done to investigate that. Martin, for example, says that if you shrunk down an average adult Homo erectus, which had a brain of about brain volume of 1,000 cubic centimeters, to get something with a brain as small as that in the Flores hominid, you'd end up with a individual that stood about a foot high and weighed 5 pounds, so that's some hobbit.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Sharon in Michigan. Hi, Sharon.
Yes, hi, Ira. How are you?
How are you? Go ahead.
Good. First off, I just want to comment. Dr. DeHansel, what an amazing discovery with Lucy. In 1992 was the first time I had a chance to see her when I was studying archaeology in Nairobi, and I have to say, it gave me chills to see this specimen. But my comment, or my question actually for your panel is, with all these discoveries that we're seeing in the last 10 years, I was wondering if you guys thought that over the next 10 or 20 years that we might see some more discoveries that would really shake up our understanding of the evolution of hominids and or their dispersion throughout the world. And I'll take my comment off the air.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And certainly the specimen from Flores, Indonesia, is an important lesson to us. I agree with Blake that the jury is still out. I've not seen the specimen, but I have held in my hand a cast of the skull. And it looks astonishingly like a regular human skull that has been shrunk in size. And if this is the case, it challenges a lot of ideas of human brain growth, because we've always mm-hmm. thought that natural selection was selecting only for larger and larger brains. And here was a brain that was about the size of a Lucy brain that was 3.2 million years before. I suspect there will be a lot of surprises out there. Journalists often ask me when I go to the field, what do you expect to find? And my answer always is the unexpected, because we're just looking at the tip of the iceberg. We've just scratched the surface. I think we're going to see a lot more species out there. I think we're going to find that hominids diversified into a whole series of environmental, ecological, behavioral niches, and it's going to get more difficult to sort out ancestor-descendant relationships. But that's really the charm, the excitement of doing this kind of science, mm-hmm. to be in something, in a science where you know a discovery can get you to think about things in a totally different way.
Do you ever find fossils from something that's not in your field, like maybe a dinosaur fossil, and you say, hey, maybe I ought to call Michael Novacek and have him come over and take a look at something like this?
Well, if I found a dinosaur fossil, I would know that the deposits were older than 65 million years, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. since humans didn't get here till, you know, 5, 6, or 7 million years, I certainly would call Michael in to look at things. But we find tons, literally tons. If you were to go to the National Museum in Addis Ababa, you would walk into a huge room filled with literally tens of tons of fossils, and most of them would be elephants and rhinos and hippopotamus and monkeys and giraffes and antelopes and so on. Hominids are very rare in the landscape, and it's very rare to find them. So the site of Hadar, where Lucy was found, where we have some 380 specimens or so, is an extraordinary site. It's the richest single place in all of Africa. That's why it's actually so important.
And what makes it, what gives it that, what traits about where the finds are located?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, because when I was a novice in the early 1970, working in southern Ethiopia, the geological deposits were brought there by a large paleo river, so that animals would fall into that river and decay, and because of the power of the moving water, they would be broken up and scattered, and sometimes you only find tiny fragments or isolated teeth. The site of Hadar is so important, as is Dikika, because it was an ancient lake, so it was a very low-energy environment. So a creature like Lucy, who probably died near the edge of the lake, fell into the lake, was floated out into the lake, and eventually decayed, the skeleton still hanging together with the ligaments fell to the bottom and was covered slowly by sand and silt and clay and slowly turned from organic material into fossil-hard stone. So it is the depositional environment. It's the place where you die that it makes the major difference between dying in a river and dying in a lake.
1-800-989-8255. Blake, let's talk about the oldest known Homo sapiens specimen, Homo 1, correct?
That's correct.
How far back have we pushed who we are?
Well, we've almost doubled the antiquity of modern humans in Africa. And this specimen, Homo 1, we had in the first edition of the book, but since that was published, people have gone back to the field, John Flegel and John Shea, among others, to the site in the Omo Basin of southern Ethiopia. And very interesting, they were able to relocate the original site from the 1960s. And that was an expedition that Richard Leakey and Clark Howell co-led that found the partial skeleton initially. They found some additional bones that matched the specimen that had been found, you know, 30, 40 years earlier. But most importantly, they were able to redate. They found some ash that allowed them to redate the sediments and found that this specimen was 195,000 years old. The date had previously been very uncertain due to the techniques that had been applied, so it's amazing. And we also have it in the book side by side with another specimen from Ethiopia that Tim White and his colleagues have found at a site known as Herto, and that one's more than 150,000 years old. So animals that and people that looked very much like us were walking around even earlier than we thought in Africa.
Mm-hmm. Talking with Donald Johansson and Blake Edgar, authors of From Lucy to Language. Does that older age change, then, the story of how Homo sapiens evolved?
Well, if I can jump in here, I think that we're now touching on an incredibly interesting part of the human career, and that is the question that most people keep in their mind. You know, where did we come from? Where did I come from? Where did Homo sapiens come from? When I was a graduate student at the University of Chicago, the finishing school for humanity was Europe. That's where we really became who we were. We painted the caves of Lascaux. We were the Cro-Magnons and so on. And, of course, that was because Europeans were all writing those books, of course. And as we delve deeper into the past, particularly in Africa, we're finding that unquestionably the origins of our own species, Homo sapiens, supposedly wise man, as Linnaeus called us, is quintessentially African. We don't know if it's Ethiopia or Kenya or South Africa, but we do know beyond a shadow of a doubt now that our immediate ancestors, the people who came into Europe and replaced the Neanderthals, were not white-skinned. They were probably very dark-skinned. They brought with them very sophisticated technology that we're beginning to see the earliest traces of in Africa. They brought with them, I think, fully articulate symbolic language, which was probably a product of their life ways, particularly as hunter-gatherers. And when we look for the origins of all humanity today, let's not just look at Europe, because I think Africa was the cradle, the crucible that created us as Homo sapiens.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Talking with Donald Johanson and Blake Edgar, authors of From Lucy to Language. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Does this recent discovery of the genetic material from Neanderthal and the possibility of looking at the genome, does that help you guys in any way?
Oh, absolutely. I was talking this morning to Ann Stone, who is here at ASU at Arizona State University. She worked on the original DNA that was extracted from the very first Neanderthal that was found in 1856, and I asked her this morning what she thought of the new work. We have some new work coming out of the Max Planck Institute in Leipzig, Germany, where Svante Paabo is in the process of extracting not just this mitochondrial DNA that's in the little powerhouses of the cell, but actual nuclear DNA from the nucleus of the cell. And he is predicting over the next 4 or 5 years to actually produce a Neanderthal genome. It's certainly the work is in its infancy, but already we know from the sequences that he's looking at that they are not us, or we are not them. That Neanderthals were undoubtedly a different species. We can see it now not only in the anatomy and the behavior, the artifacts, the geographic distribution, but we can see it in the genes. And this takes us back to 100,000 years ago, which clearly shows that Neanderthal genes are not running around in modern humans.
Do you hold out the hope then that we could find genetic material, viable genes that are even older?
Well, I think so. I think that it, again, depends on the process of fossilization. We have a project underway at the moment in southern Africa. One of my colleagues at the Institute, Curtis Marion, is looking at the evidence for human modern behavior. He has found ochre pencils. He's found engravings and so on that are as much as 70 or 100 or 150,000 years old. If he can find human fossil remains there in the caves that have been closed, like the Neanderthal cave was, we might perhaps be able to get very, very early DNA from Homo sapiens.
But I should point out that it's very hard-won data, as Svante Paabo would be the first to tell you. Really difficult. He, along with others, have set up strict protocols to try to avoid contamination and make sure that what you're finding mm-hmm. is really DNA from the specimen involved.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me go to the phones and talk to Ed in Ann Arbor. Hi, Ed.
Hi there. I just had a question. I've heard that some anthropologists and archaeologists have been somewhat reluctant to share their fossil findings, specific measurements of their fossils, and cast to the scientific community as a whole. I was wondering what your panel thought about if that's holding up the scientific process at all. Is that is that stopping, you know, people from nailing down some of these origins? And I appreciate it. Take my answer off the air.
Thank you.
Yeah, I faced this dilemma just after the discovery of Lucy, because the Ethiopian government did not have at that time a laboratory to work in Addis Ababa. And Lucy and the other fossils from Hadar made the trip to Cleveland, where I was a curator at the Natural History Museum. And there they were in my lab in the United States, and everybody came knocking on my door with their calipers. Oh, I want to measure this. I want to measure that. I want to photograph this. And I realized I had a responsibility to share these discoveries with the greater scientific community. And it paid off big, because those people found things in the skeletons and fragments that I had missed. Some of my ideas were wrong, and so on. And it opened up a whole generation of scientists right now And it was very positive. At the moment, there are a number of people in the field who have made discoveries 14 years ago, and we still haven't seen them.
All right, we'll talk about it more. Come back, talk more with Donald Johansson and co-author Blake Edgar. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. I'm Ira Flatow, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We've just got a few more minutes to talk with Donald Johansson and Blake Edgar, authors of From Lucy to Language. Donald, it seems like the book now is already sort of out of date. You got to go back a little further than Lucy. We need a new book soon, I would imagine.
Well, that makes the publishers happy, I think. I hope we'll have another edition.
We could have called it From Tumai to Language, but that's less alliterative.
right. So just summing up, this is still an exciting time, Don, for paleontologists.
Yeah, I think it's a very exciting time because in spite of all of the acrimony and in spite of all of the infighting that goes on among paleoanthropologists, there is a general consensus now that all of the important developments in human evolution, upright walking, separation from the apes, upright walking, acquisition of large brains, production of stone tools, acquisition of bodies of modern proportions, the appearance of Homo sapiens are all African events. And that's something that everybody seems to agree on. And what a vindication for Charles Darwin and Thomas Henry Huxley and others who pointed their finger at Africa as the cradle of humankind long before anybody had ever found a fragment of fossil in Africa. So I think that that is an important perspective that is uniting the field. And all of us are trying to do our best to find the fragments that will help us fill in the details.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll try not to make it another 10 years before we have you back, Don.
Well, so. I'm happy to come back anytime.
Thank you. Don Johansson, co-author of The Revised From Lucy to Language, out this year from Simon & Schuster, founder and director of the Institute of Human Origins and the Virginia M. Ullman Chair in Human Origins at Arizona State University in Tempe, and Blake Edgar, co-author of From Lucy to Language, and acquisitions editor in the Science Publishing Group at UC Press at Berkeley. Thank you, gentlemen, for taking time to be with us.
Thank you.